Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be exploring an ancient flower that naturally treats diabetes. Unfortunately, Big Pharma immediately begins developing a synthetic version. Well, we don't need the synthetic version when we have the real McCoy. We'll share that with you. Also today, we're going to look at what are the fat-soluble nutrients, why we need these, and what they can do for our good health, and a lot more on health and healing. How even chimpanzees binge on clay to detoxify and boost their minerals in their diet. And then, who are the biggest killers in America? I believe the numbers will shock you. From Alternet, Zaid Jilani. We're also going to look today at the cover-up of torture in American prisons by Andrea Damon. And we're going to explore also in the second part of our program with our guest a very unusual series of conversations. The rise of hate groups in America, and new information on the KKK murders during LBJ's presidency, tying LBJ to those murders. The Reverend James Stern, having grown up in a Watts neighborhood in Los Angeles, Reverend James Stern is an African-American pastor and civil rights activist devoted to racial justice and reconciliation between blacks and whites and other races. He's the founder of No Collar, Inc. and Racial Reconciliation. I think you'll find his conversations interesting because he had a chance to sit every day and have a conversation while incarcerated in Mississippi with a Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard, recruiting Officer Edgar Ray Killen. Well, previously, Killen had been sentenced to 60 years for masterminding the murders of three civil rights workers in 1964. So, conversations between two people, one black, one white, one Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, implicated in the murders of the three civil rights workers in 1964, and the other, a person within the African-American community wanting to see justice done. That'll be an interesting conversation. So we have a lot to share today. Let's begin. It's interesting when you watch an elephant that is deficient in a certain mineral, because all elephants will be able to find certain types of caves or rock formations where they will use their tusks and they will rake back and forth and back and forth, and they'll take this into their system. They'll consume it. And when they've had enough, they leave. They may not come back for several months. You see this in different species. But they found something in watching a group of chimpanzees. The people watching were a group of scientists in Oxford University in the United Kingdom. They published an interesting paper in PLOS One, and they found that wild chimpanzees in the forests of Uganda are increasingly eating clay to supplement the minerals in their diet. This was a long-term international study. And the paper led by the University of Oxford describes how the researchers observed wild chimpanzees in the forest eating and drinking from clay pits and termite mounds. The paper went into depth about how once they have the minerals they need, they no longer touch it. And we know that birds will eat certain particular berries that they normally would not eat, would not be part of the diet, to get rid of parasites. Other animals do the same. I just find it interesting that we just try to see the phenomena we don't understand. We call it instinct, and I call it sailor intellect. And on an upcoming program, I'll go into this in greater depth, how we have this. How many times have you been around someone and you just didn't feel right? You knew no matter what the person said or did, there was just something that was not clicking. Well, that is the intuition letting you know that this person is not harmonizing with your energy. It doesn't mean the person is a bad person. It's not a moral judgment. In the same way we're in the right place, we know it. When they're in the wrong place, we feel it. Well, that is a universal law, and universal laws are applicable universally. It's no different than when a major scientific breakthrough just recently showed that trees talk with one another. Okay. Well, why don't you ask the Native Americans about trees talking? They've had that reality for a long time. In our hubris and our arrogance, we like to believe that reality only begins when we have scientific validation of it. Now think of that. So there's no reality in life that you should trust or believe in or have confidence in or faith in because it hasn't been scientifically validated. And that's when and only when they'll trust something, when it's scientifically validated. However, much of what is supposed to be scientifically validated today is completely wrong. It is fraudulent. It has been manipulated by special interest groups. So what do we believe? And I believe that reality supersedes scientific validation. And hence, we are not born incomplete. So if trees can talk with one another, that means, as a universal truth, everything on the planet has to be able to communicate with everything else on the planet. That we only think things are inanimate. We think things are a particular way because we do not understand the energy and how that energy translates, the vibration it's on. No different, and I'll bring it real close to simple. Let's just say that you're sitting talking. About every 8 seconds you blink. Why? Did anyone tell you early in life you got to blink every 8 seconds or you go blind? You have to create a tear on the lens. No. Why is it every human on the planet and every creature on the planet has to blink to protect their eyes? That's a universal truth. And that there's saliva that pours out of your little tiny two holes underneath your tongue. And without that saliva, you would die. Your mouth would dry out. Your throat would dry out. Nothing could go down it. Bacterial overgrowth would immediately occur. But you do. How does it know how much saliva, how much is too much, and how much is too little? But it does. When you stand up, your heartbeat goes up. When you sit down, it goes down. When you lie down, it goes down again. Your metabolism at night slows down 8 to 10%. Hence, your whole body is on a lower metabolic rate at night. Who told it to do that? What class were you given to learn that? None. There are over 500 different biological processes in your liver to detoxify you every millisecond. Also conjugation, bringing things together that are one way, conjugating them, and then putting them into the system or taking them out of the system as needed. Toxins going out, nutrients coming in. Your body doesn't digest vitamin B6. It has to convert it from pyridoxine to pyridoxal 5-phosphate. How does it know to do that? And it does it in every human being, no matter what time of the millennial they were born in. Your skin temperature will stay the same, no matter how cold, or your internal temperature, no matter how cold or hot. It could be 120, or it could be minus 50. How does it know to constrict, to hold in the heat, or to open it up and sweat? But it does. So we have over 100 trillion, with a T, trillion, processes occurring in our body every microsecond. That's a fraction of a second, without ever being taught a single lesson. Now, what we're taught comes into a different realm of our reality, our conditioned response to stimuli. So, for those who are the cynic, the skeptics, the pessimist about life, maybe I'd understand that all matter communicates through vibration. Everything is energy. And everything in life is an exchange of energy. You can either exchange positive energy or negative energy. but you're born a positive energy, all of us. Now, maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe there's some exception you can show me, but I've never seen a baby born a racist. I've never seen a baby born wanting to come out and kill anyone. Condition them, and they can do both. Without that conditioning, they won't. So we honor the conditioned mind, the conditioned rules, the conditioned contract of society, religion, politic. And when we do that, we have fractured the truth. And a fractured truth never heals. So everything comes after that is going to be itself fractured. So why don't we get back to authentic living and thinking and being and just be appreciative of the gift of life, because it is indeed a gift. And there was a consciousness aware in your cells before you had a brain consciousness, though you wouldn't know it from some people's actions. So here we look at a chimpanzee, and that's the study. And they're not stepping back and saying, is this a part of a universal truth that when species are out of balance, they will seek something normally not a part of their diet? Well, then why don't we look at what we need to do to seek something as humans to rebalance us when something's not in the right amount in our life, like support, love, appreciation, and honoring us as human beings? And think of nature, sitting in nature, looking at a stream, walking barefoot on the sand, looking from a mountain peak out over a valley, walking through the leaves in the fall, smelling the fresh cut grass in the spring. These are all energies communicating with our eternal life energy. Other cultures have mastered it. We have mastered the technology of our distractions. What is the number three killer in the United States in hospitals? Well, it is the hospital stay. According to the latest study, Western medicine and all of its advances, where people are flocking by the millions every week to get some kind of high-level medical care, one out of every 25 patients that will get the treatment will end up getting an infection. Those infections, according to the CDC's latest report, will cause 722,000 patients to be seriously ill and stay in a hospital. 75,000 of them, or 10%, will die. And yet, when was last time there was a major effort to understand when you're weakened in your immune system and you go into any infected environment, there's a probability you're going to be infected. If you're strong in your immune system and you go into a weakened environment, you may be infected, but you're not going to die more often than not. Your body will recover because it's strong. So why not have a remedial course of what to do to prepare yourself for any form of hospitalization? It doesn't take long. You could do a class in under an hour. And that could help people have stronger immune systems no matter what they're faced with, and that could save lives. But do the hospitals take credit for being dispensers of major infections? They kill more Americans, hospitals do, of infection than anyone else dying in the United States in those numbers. Now, that's just hospital-borne infection. That's only one part of the story. An estimated 440,000 Americans are dying each year from preventable hospital errors, including injury, illness, and infection. And those are very sobering statistics. And then you have patients who die, but not because of doctor error, nurse error, orderly error, infections, but because of properly given medications. We over-medicate people. We give them medications to counter the effects of other medications, where in and of themselves, the logic is that if a person has high blood pressure, by giving this medication to lower the blood pressure, we don't look at, will it also damage the kidneys? Yes. Will it damage the liver? Yes. Will it impact liver enzymes? Yes. Will it possibly cause a heart attack? Yes. By giving people statins, does that destroy coenzyme Q10? Yes. By giving them a mini aspirin, can that thin the blood? Yes. Will that help prevent a stroke? Yes. But will that also destroy vitamin B6, folic acid, B12, and vitamin C that help prevent a heart attack? Yes. So on the one hand, we prevent a stroke and kill you by a heart attack with an elevated homocysteine. It's all perfectly logical. You will never be criticized for killing someone as long as you followed the protocol. Hence, the patient is irrelevant. The protocol is essential. We reward people for following protocols even if every single patient was to die. If every patient in America went to their doctor and every single patient, no matter what, they went for a toothache, they went because you got a splinter in your finger, or you went because of abdominal surgery, if every single patient died, no doctor would be reprimanded, no system would be changed, because the logic is you're rewarded, the hospital would be rewarded, the anesthesiologists, the technicians, the suppliers of the scalpels, the suppliers of the saline bags, everybody is in line to be rewarded. So you cannot not reward people at the same time that you're condemning them for being part of the, hold on, why are you charging $30,000 for a single use of a single chemotherapy agent when the same agent in Egypt is only $800? Well, because we can charge that here in profit and non-profit hospitals. So everybody profits except the patients. So when you add up how many patients die because of properly given medicines, but the shouldn't have been given at all, then American medicine is the number one cause of death in the United States every year, more than heart attacks, strokes, cancer, and diabetes. And yet not a single thing will be written or spoken or done to change any of it. Because in America, we're unique in rewarding for effort and never considering results. Something just fundamentally stupid about that. To give you an idea, well, yesterday I mentioned that the official figure is 4,000 people dying every day in China. And a friend last night said, you know, I heard your figure, Gary, and I think people would get a better idea of that if you put it into context, like, say, something everyone in New York knows, for example, that we're heard worldwide, but everybody knows Madison Square Garden. It holds somewhere north of 25,000 there, more or less. Well, okay, that's exactly 5 days. Every 5 days, enough Chinese die of air pollution, just air pollution. We're not talking about water pollution now. That's a separate amount of deaths. We're not talking about a cancer due to the coal. We're just talking about air particulate. So you could fill every week of the year, not even every week, every 5 days, you could fill Madison Square Garden with dead bodies. So every seat is taken by a dead Chinese person with a little note that says, this week, everyone in these seats, all 25,000, this 5 days, died of air pollution. But how about this? Every 27 days, you could fill Madison Square Garden with a dead body of someone who got good medicine or the right medicine, but their body couldn't handle it. Hence, they were maltreated. Or a medical error, or an infection they got from the hospital, or malnutrition they got from the hospital, or a doctor not properly sanitizing their hands before surgery, or let's say a dentist taking the headset and putting it on you, not realizing that headset had not been sanitized before someone before you did, and then touches your mouth. Now you end up with a massive infection. How many people are injured each day, not dead, injured each day in the United States? Okay, it's 10,000. Well, 10,000, the largest stadium that I'm aware of, there may be a larger one, it's up University of Michigan, I believe it's 110,000, can sit in it. Just imagine this. Every 11 days, you could put a person injured by American medicine in every seat in the largest sports arena stadium in America. Every 11 days. And it never stops. So just be aware that when you believe that you have nothing to fear, there is nothing life-threatening or injurious that could happen by going into a hospital, think again. And also, what have I not included? Every person that is injured or dies at home from the medicine or medical procedure. So if you die in a hospital, it counts. If you die at home from the procedure or medicine you're taking from the hospital, it doesn't. It's on no one's records. Now, for those of you who have any of the problems like UCI or some of the other conditions, there is one herb that really is good for pain, and that's willow bark. Willow bark is valued as an anti-inflammatory. The bark has been known to break the fever and reduce pain and inflammation. And other herbs and plants are valued because of their ability to improve overall health and general quality of life. One of the herbs that we do not pay attention enough in our society is rhodiola. Rhode, R-H-O-D-I-O-L-A, I-O-L-A, rhodiola, rosea, R-O-S-E-A. It's also called golden root, and it's been used in Ayurvedic medicine and other natural healing traditions in Asia for thousands of years. It's one of the best overall health tonics you can have. As a pick-me-upper, as an energy rebooster, is adaptogenic. It's a yellow-flowering alpine plant, and with one of the long histories of medicinal use. In fact, University of California, Irvine, the scientists were looking for the effects of the plant on the human body, and they found that by taking rhodiola, the active ingredients in rhodiola were able to act on the biological pathways that support better overall body functions and lengthening the lifespan. Now, this discovery is considered to be significant. Traditionally, the medical community has held that dietary restriction is one of the key components of lengthening lifespan, meaning caloric restriction, especially restriction of things like sodium and saturated fats. In fact, however, rhodiola worked even when those dietary restrictions were not in place. And then they found it actually lengthened lifespan, in this case of fruit flies. It was one of the things they used to determine life expectancy. It improved the lifespan of fruit flies by 25%. So, rhodiola for overall life expectancy, for better performance, for helping your body. It's just an overall great tonic. And finally, scientific evidence reveals the cancer-fighting power of beets. Absolutely. Now, when I went on the road this morning, I took my coconut water and my fresh organic beet juice with my supplements that I always should take before you go on a workout, like coenzyme Q10 and magnesium from citrate and your vitamin E from mixed tocopherols and vitamin C and cayenne, because that all helps your blood and helps prevent a heart attack or stroke. But also the nitric oxide that allows greater microcirculation to your brain. Therefore, beet juice would be great for people with poor neuropathy conditions or inflammation in the feet, poor circulation, little splotchy veins, spider veins, broken blood vessels, but also people who have dementia, memory loss, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. Beet juice, 2 glasses a day, would be terrific for you. But now, according to Dr. Alexander Frenenzi at the Department of Internal Disease at the Cosmo Hungary University, they found that beets help fight cancer. And that's important. And this was in the Australian International Clinical Nutrition Review. In one study, for example, a 50-year-old man suffering from lung tumors, which corresponded clinically to lung cancer, was treated with beetroot. And in just 6 weeks, the tumor had disappeared. And after 4 months, the man gained back the weight loss that he had during his cancer. And his blood work results corresponded to clinical recovery. In another study, a prostate cancer sufferer and uterine cancer patient were both admitted to the hospital. At the time of admission, both weighed the same. The man with the prostate cancer received beetroot treatment, but the doctor noted that the uterine cancer patient could not take it. And although he had been bedridden with a catheter When admitted, the man was able to have his catheter removed after a month and soon began walking around and putting back on weight. The female patient, however, continued to lose weight. After just 3 months, there was a weight difference of 23 pounds between the two. The fact that other iron-rich foods do not have the same effect could mean the benefits of beets and something in the beets, possibly in its coloring, could be doing the work. Now, no one has isolated everything in the beet, but clearly something in that beet is a catalyst that helps the body, and it's terrific. So right now, since we do not have all the information on what it is in the beet, just the beets are good and good for you and good for longer and better athletic performance. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's take a break and come back. We have a lot more to share with you. Welcome all of you from all over the world and all the different countries and cities listening on your terrestrial land-based stations, listening over the telephone, which an enormous amount of people do every day, or listening over the internet. We welcome you to this program. Also, I mentioned that I would give a little word about the fat-soluble vitamins because they're so important for your immune system. Vitamin D, fish oil, coenzyme Q10, vitamin E, especially the alpha and gamma forms, vitamin K, lycopene, zeaxanthin, mesozeaxanthin, and astaxanthin. Those are the ones that support a longer, and also ascorbyl palmitate, those are the ones that support a longer life in your blood and are very important for immune function. Now, the criminal justice reform movement has shined a light on the inhumane conditions in our prisons. We've talked about this on numerous occasions on this program. In fact, tonight on the Progressive Commentary Hour, we will take a look at what is happening in Russia, the Ukraine, the truth about the American complicity in starting this revolution there, NATO. It's a really heady show for people who want in-depth understanding of an issue. So if you can, at 7 o'clock, tune in or download it off the archives, the Progressive Commentary Hour. Professor Paul Craig Roberts being one of the guests. But recently we did a show on the Progressive Commentary Hour looking at why we have so many people in prison and why are we creating laws that make just minor offenses punishable by prison? Because someone is profiting from it. This movement has done important work in demonstrating the needless brutality involved in our system, particularly as it is directed against marginalized groups, mainly the poor and racial minorities. Recently, Jade Gilani examined the economic backgrounds of those killed by police just this year and found that between January and May of this year, 95% of police killings occurred in neighborhoods with an average income under $100,000. There were no killings in neighborhoods with incomes of $200,000 or above. Now, he receives many responses, but one of the most common is that the wealthy simply don't commit as much street crime. In other words, the rich behave themselves, so the police don't bother with them, right? Well, there is truth in this argument in one dimension. Street crime It has long been a consensus among sociologists and economists that high levels of poverty and inequality are associated with various street crimes, such as homicide and assault. However, this doesn't actually mean that the poor and middle class are harming people on a more frequent basis or stealing more of their property or destroying more of their wealth. It is a little-known fact that the richest Americans not only steal more wealth through white-collar crime, but their crimes also lead to the deaths of more people. Yet despite the destructiveness of rich criminals, our criminal justice system does not respond in the same way it tackles crimes by poor Americans. So how the rich commit crimes? And we can thank Zaid Jilani for his research. You may know Jeffrey Raymond. He's a criminologist and a sociologist and philosopher based at American University. He's appeared in the media a lot. And in 1979, he published the first edition of the book, The Rich Get Richer, The Poor Get Prison. And the book had a simple but counterintuitive thesis. The rich are actually committing society's most destructive crimes in terms of both financial damage and loss of human lives, but our criminal justice system is harshest towards the poorest Americans whose crimes inflict the least damage. Now, as time rolled on and mass incarceration of mostly poor and working-class people skyrocketed, while prosecution of white-collar crimes dialed down, Raymond's thesis has gained steam. With his co-researchers, he has released new editions of the book with updated statistics regularly. The most recent edition was in 2013, and although much of his statistical work is somewhat outdated, in 2015, the wider narrative is as relevant today as it was when his book was originally published. He begins his explanation of the difference between deadly white-collar crime and far less deadly street crime in the second paragraph. Quote, "If it takes you an hour to read this chapter, by the time you reach the last page, two of your fellow citizens will have been murdered. During that same time, more than six Americans will die as a result of unhealthy or unsafe conditions in the workplace. Although these work-related deaths were due to human actions, they are called not murders. Why not? Doesn't a crime by any other name still cause misery and suffering? What's in a name?" End quote. Well, that's the crux of the issue. We refer to street crime as crime and tackle it with the most blunt police state instruments, but we don't respond the same way to the kinds of crimes elites commit through indifference or hunger for greater profits. Using data ranging from 1992 to 2006, Raymond estimates that 55,325 occupational-related deaths per year. This includes deaths caused by unsafe work conditions, needless exposure to disease, and other forms of death that would be a direct result of employer negligence, but does not amount to the total number of negligent workplace deaths, which is difficult to compute. Now compare this to deaths from common street crime, referred to as homicides, in the same year. It was 15,000 deaths. Raymond writes that, quote, "the risk to occupational disease and death falls only on members of the labor force, whereas the risk of crime falls on the whole population from infants to the elderly. Because the civilian labor force is about half, 50% of the total population, to get a true picture of the relative threat posed by occupational disease compared to that posed by what we refer to as crimes, we should multiply the crime statistic by half." If you do that, even discounting bad luck and errors on the part of the employee, you'd be comparing tens of thousands of occupational deaths to around 7,500 homicides. That would mean your job, through the negligence of your employer, is 700% more likely to kill you than common street crime is. And the author concludes that this means, quote, "workers are more likely to stay alive and healthy in the face of the danger from the underworld than from the work world. The primary difference between the deaths that occur in the work world versus the underworld is simply the perspective our society, which is tilted towards the worldview of the rich, gives them. A poor mugger killing you after a fight over your wallet is considered a grave crime, whereas a worker being killed because their employer didn't spend the money necessary to give them proper safety is considered routine. This is something that is immediately obvious if you look at how these crimes are punished. According to PBS's Frontline, the average time served for a homicide is 71 months. That's nearly 6 years in prison, by the way. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, as well as various state agencies, are in charge of holding companies accountable to violate safety regulations, including in circumstances where these violations lead to death. But it is rare for management or owners to be held personally responsible for any deaths. Take the recent case from Columbus, Ohio. OSHA fined a cabinet maker $50,000 after finding 21 safety violations that were, quote, discovered after the January 13 death of employer Tom Hegg. Hegg died of acute exposure to wood dust after 15 years with the company, end quote. It's often said you can't put a price on human life, but our regulatory agencies do exactly that. The author lists numerous other ways the rich get away with killing Americans yet face a less severe response from the government. One is through botched medical operations, which the Journal of the American Medical Association estimated results in 225,000 deaths a year, making them the third largest cause of death in the United States. That's just botched operations. These deaths include 88,000 to 100,000 deaths from infections and 16,000 deaths from unnecessary surgical operations. So these are just a few of the ways the rich in corporate America kill people, and there are many others that deserve to be discussed, such as spreading deadly pollution, making unsafe consumer products, pricing out the Americans of being able to get health care. And for the sake of space, let's just look at what it costs and what it means. Now, I want to share you right here. In all the investigations I've done, one overriding theme is that because of a corporate charter that protects the people from any wrongdoing, the company can simply build into all litigation and all settlements an amount of their profit, but they never once have to give back the ill-gotten gains. So when Merck was found guilty of manufacturing a drug that it knew from the beginning could increase heart attack and stroke, and 60,000-plus Americans died, and over 100,000 were injured, no one went to jail, the value of the stock went up, they earned about $12 billion. They paid a relatively small part of that, about $4.58 billion, and they got to keep all the rest. No one was harmed in the company, even though they had caused 60,000 Americans to die. And just imagine for a moment how many of those people were the breadwinners, how many of them had children and loved ones they left behind, and no one went back to say they were sorry, no one apologized, and lives were destroyed. But it was good for business. Wall Street was happy about the settlement because it could get back to making profits. And these are the people that make your vaccines. And these are the people that are criminal to the core in their ethics when it comes to making a profit above helping the larger public health good. Those are my thoughts. I'd like to hear yours now. We're going to take your calls on TalkBack and then go to our guest. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please be with us. Let's now go over to our guest, because we have a lot of insights to learn from him. I gave you his background earlier from Southern California. Let's say hello to the Reverend James Stern. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. How you doing today?
Good. I'd like to start with looking back at the civil rights movement in the mid-1960s, a period of strict segregation, and when militant racist and anti-Semitic groups such as the KKK had a relatively positive standing within the Deep South's white culture. And certainly many politicians during this time favored segregation and had no interest whatsoever in bringing the black community to the level of whites in sharing the opportunities of the nation in the democratic process at that time. But we must not think that the KKK was simply an aberrant, militant organization of perverted national patriotism that acted outside of the social power structures. So begin by sharing with us what you learned during your many personal and confidential conversations with Klansman Edgar Killen and a summary of the letters you received from him. In fact, later Killen attempted to have you return them, and you can share anything about how political powers use the Klan for ulterior motives to shape America's perceptions of the events of that time.
Thank you, Gary. Well, first of all, I want to say I'm excited about the times we live in right now, first of all. It's a good time to be alive. Edgar Ray Killen used to always say his favorite speech every time somebody came near him, he used to say it's a good day to die. Well, I say it's a good day to live. Edgar Ray Killen is from the 60s. He's from the era of the 50s and the 60s, at the time when it was socially acceptable to be the way he was. The Klan of then and the Klan of now are like day and night in political power and power, period. Edgar, he was the imperial wizard of the KKK. He had powers that was beyond most people's understanding, because he was the man. He lived in a time when he had judges, senators, congressmen, sheriffs. He had everybody in any key position of life subscribe to his way of thinking, which was, as you said, segregation. We know Senator Easton was one of the probably the biggest segregationists in the South. And because of their deep desire not to have integration, they went through any extremes. But I need to take you back a little further, Gary. Rather, I believe any of these things are not, because I didn't live during that time. These are things are from Edgar Ray Killen and various individuals who gave me insight while I was locked up with them. After the Civil War, the South considered themselves to have been occupied by carpetbaggers. And they feel for 10 years they were under occupation, having outsiders from other states, from the United States, from the federal government, to come in and occupy them in their way of lifestyle. So they feel that they had to do something to preserve their way of life, whether we agree with it or not. This is their way. When we have the understanding of how the other side think, we can probably know how to make changes. That's one of the reasons why I tolerated Edgar Ray Killen and listened to what he had to say. They believed that they had to develop a system that was going to preserve their way of life, and that was the KKK. As far as enforcement in many ways. They were 4 million strong he had control over. Death was a way of life for him, because he was the imperial wizard. He was a green reaper. He decided who lived and died, you know, during this period of time. The civil rights movement did not start the way most people realize it started. We don't have a clue to the background to that. The civil rights movement started really with the attempt to erase the sting of the Vietnam War on one president, Lyndon B. Johnson. Lyndon B. Johnson was getting hit hard every time a body bag came home from the Vietnam War. Anti-war people was just hammering his reputation. So he called in Senator Easton into the office one day and told him to do something about the GD Vietnam War. And Senator Easton, being a very powerful senator in Mississippi, he said, I have just the thing to do. And he went back home and called Edgar Ray Killen, who was the imperial wizard, and called him to his the Eastern plantation. And he told him, he says, start killing every black person under the age of 16. And Edgar was confused himself. Edgar said, why under 16? But, Gary, this is going to shock you. The law in Mississippi, even up until 2005, stated that there was no such thing as kidnapping a black male who was under 16 years old. For it to be considered kidnapping, he had to be over 16 years old. So that's how they got out of the charges of kidnapping. They always targeted young black men who was under 16. And when they did all this, at their surprise, one summer, Freedom Summer, the summer of the Freedom Summer, you had Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner's case came about. Schwerner and Goodman came into town. They were coming in there to help train African Americans to register to vote and train them to be able to be perpetual and go out there and get other black people to vote. And Ben Cheney, which was not supposed to be the driver, which was by mistake, he took a job that wasn't his, as Edgar would say, he drove Goodman and Schwerner to the attempted to drive them to the Gulf Coast to do their job. And we know the story about how they got killed, we think. But let me just say that that whole story of Mississippi burning that we saw didn't have a clue on half of what really happened. Because Edgar Ray Killens would never talk about it. The first time he ever talked about the stories was me in a cell. And so the things that
Hold on. Let's slow it down, please, and keep focus.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're telling us now, you're telling this audience, which is all over the world right now, mm-hmm. that the Mississippi Burning, which was based upon a best-selling book, and then a film with, I think it was Gene Hackman, that was only partial truth, and you sat in the cell with a man who orchestrated it, so you're going to now tell us the truth of what actually happened, right?
Well, okay, first, what I can do is say this to you. I'm trying to get... Gary, I respect and love your show, but because there's a major feature film, let me explain something. I have over 174 letters of Edgar attempting to write down as much as he could. You know, understand, there's not enough paper for a year and 6 months of inmates sitting in prison. I'm in Parchman, the worst prison in the country, Unit 31. So it was not like he was going to be able to write down word for word everything that happened. What he did do is he spent 2 to 3 hours a day talking to me about the whole story. But what he did in letters was let the world know some of the key incidents and let the world know that he taught me everything he knew. Edgar told me so much about his life.
But share it now. Don't tease us.
I can only share
tell
so
us.
Much. No, because I'll be responsible. Here's the thing, Gary. I understand before everybody would love to have the sound bites and everything, but I have to be responsible to history. Because there's so much that people need to know in a chronological...
Hold on, friend. I'm not asking you for a soundbite. I give more time than any other radio program in the world for guests to talk and lay out their story.
What I'm saying is that I don't...
Tell us what you know.
I can only say this. I'm going to tell the world what I know. But it has
You mean you're coming on to do a promotion for something? Then this conversation's over.
Gary,
all right,
Gary,
I'm sorry. This conversation's over. I don't. That's an abuse of my audience. You come on to say you got something to say, friend. You say it, but don't say it's why I can't tell you because something else. I'm sorry. This interview is over. Sorry about that. Okay, you want to come on this show? You tell it like it is. I give you all the time in the world, but don't play me and my audience for fools. We're going to take a break, we're going to come back, and we're going to play you a clip that I was going to play. I think you'll find it interesting. It's an important discussion, and this discussion has to do with policing for profit. Please listen in.
If police suspect that you committed a crime, they can arrest you and put you on trial. At that trial, prosecutors must prove you are guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But if police suspect your car was involved in a crime, they can take it, sell it, and in most places, pocket the proceeds to pad their budgets. They need not prove you committed any crime or even arrest you to take your property away. Welcome to the upside-down world of civil asset forfeiture. With civil forfeiture, your property is guilty until you prove it innocent to get it back. And because most state and federal laws allow police and prosecutors to pocket the proceeds, they have a big incentive to pursue profits, not justice. How big? In 1986, the Justice Department's forfeiture fund took in $94 million. Now, it has more than a billion. State and local agencies receive forfeiture funds too. But we don't know how much because most states don't publicly report on forfeiture. No surprise, abuse is rampant. One New York police department spent forfeiture funds on food, gifts, and entertainment. In Georgia, forfeiture funds paid for football tickets for a DA's office. And a DA in Texas used forfeiture dollars to buy TV ads for his re-election campaign. Meanwhile, citizens are seeing cash, cars, and other property taken away for the flimsiest of reasons. Carrying too much cash? Police can accuse you of selling drugs or laundering money and seize it. No conviction or even arrest required. An Institute for Justice study grades state laws on how well they protect people from wrongful forfeitures. Only 3 states receive a B or better. The rest range from mediocre to awful. And so does federal law. Worse, a federal legal loophole allows police and prosecutors to bypass state protections and keep pocketing forfeiture money. IJ's research shows that the easier and more profitable these laws make forfeiture, the more it is used and abused. It's time to end civil forfeiture. People shouldn't have their property taken away without being convicted of a crime. And law enforcement shouldn't be policing for profit.
Last year, more than $4 billion was confiscated from innocent Americans without them being charged with anything. Now imagine you're pulled over, you're not speeding, you're going on holiday with your family, and they ask you, do you have any money? And you say, well, just what we have on us to go to the amusement park down at Disney World. And they say, well, how much is that? And you say, about $1,500, because we have to pay for a lot of stuff. And they say, well, give me the money. And you say, why? Well, because it may be related to drugs. And you say, well, we're not doing drugs. We're not transporting drugs. So they tell you, get out of the car. You get out of the car. They search the car. They can find no drugs. But they confiscate all the money from all of you, your kids, you. And then they send you on your way. And they say, you say, but this is not right. They say, well, we're confiscating the money. If you say anything about this to us, then we can arrest you. What charge? Resisting arrest. For what? I've committed no crime. It's nothing but a Byzantine corrupt mess. Our President of the United States knows this. The head of the Justice Department, the Attorney General knows this. All the senior officers of the court in the Justice Department know this. Your Attorney General at your state knows this. Everybody in the police knows this. A legal way to steal from Americans billions of dollars a year, and nothing is being done about it. Nothing. I guess when it happens to people, then it becomes personal. I'm going to play you something now. It's a little segment, but I believe it's important. It's called From Jason Scott, Why I Hate Society, But I Love Humanity, The Spoken Word. Think you'll find it interesting and insightful.
In our society today, do you class yourself as free? Or are you constantly clinging on to things which give no guarantee? Do our materialistic items ever deliver to us real happiness? Or do they distort us from reality, and for our conscience, are they poisonous? See, happiness comes within, yet we always tend to forget. We spend our whole lives chasing money, and on our deathbed seem to regret. I used to be unaware of this. I'd let others shape my desires. I'd give in to authority's logic, only to realize it just came from liars. See, I would always be looking for freedom, but I never found it until I realized that in order to truly experience it, then maybe I should just dematerialize. However, there are only few who live this way, though sometimes stereotyped as pathetic. But honestly, to be fair, it's those who judge that are wrongly apathetic. See, this was me 3 years ago. I was ignorant, naive, with plenty of confidence. I'm only 20 now, but I realised that back then I just had no social conscience. And you may think, this might be me, or you may just not have realised yet, but if getting wasted just doesn't fulfil you, then on that, I'd place a bet. See, apparently we're doing things the right way, hunting fame for the reward of happiness. But does this actually fulfil us, or do we forget about just living in contentedness? It's like just because we don't break laws, it doesn't necessarily make us innocent. African children are dying and suffering from illness, and we're sat there cursing immigrants. See, first world problems are always seen on the news, prioritised over third world needs. We apparently preach we're all human, yet seem to be incapable of such good deeds. And this is real immaturity, yet it mostly comes from adults, who would have thought? We don't accept responsibility for our planet, and we just hope we don't get caught. In World War I and World War II, those people fought for our peace. We taught respect in history, but the morals we've learned have mostly deceased. For example, if we know that violence only promotes more violence, then why do we still fight wars? If we really want to protect each other, then why aren't we removing the root cause? See, we need to stop following public opinion and start thinking properly for ourselves. We need to stop separating nations and throw our pride upon the shelves. I've learned that just because I'm not blind, it doesn't automatically make me see. Are you satisfied with the way things are, or are you searching for truth like me? You can't tell me we're fulfilling that purpose. We seem to ignore it more each day. We pretend we're en route to peace on Earth, but truthfully, we've lost our way. And you may think that I'm just illogical. You may think I'm just a dreamer. You may think this is all inevitable, but trust me, I'm not just your average believer. See, it's our society that is unworthy. We seem to be forgetting how we got here. You would have thought that we have matured by now and realised that time is dear. Because if humanity doesn't become aware of this, and if our ignorance goes too far, then the future for all life is ruined, because one day our Earth will scar.
Very prophetic. And I want to close out our program today by examining the cover-up of torture in America's prisons. Let me quote this from Andrea Damon. Last week, the New York Times reported allegations that prison guards systematically tortured inmates at Clinton Correctional Facility in upstate New York following the high-profile escape of two inmates. More than 60 prisoners filed complaints claiming they suffered abuse, including beatings, stranglings, and death threats. Most significant, however, was the apparent personal involvement of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat, in these brutal actions. Just hours before state prison guards, without name tags, descended upon the cell block to torture the escapees' fellow prisoners, Cuomo had visited the prison, asking one inmate in the presence of the media why he did not hear the escapees cutting through their prison bars. Quote, "It must have kept you awake with all that cutting, huh?" before giving him his best tough guy stare, according to the prisoner, and walking off. Cuomo later told ABC News, quote, "I chatted with a couple of the inmates myself, and I said, you must be a very heavy sleeper. They had to have heard, end quote. Within a matter of hours, the inmate Cuomo spoke to was asked by an unnamed guard, "You know what waterboarding is?" before having his head thrust into a plastic bag hanging from a pipe and being beaten for 20 minutes. Another inmate reported being hung by a plastic bag used as a noose until he passed out. Despite these shocking revelations, not a single national news outlet has commented on the incident since Wednesday or even bothered to follow up on the story. These included the supposed newspaper of record, the New York Times, whose breaking of the story amounted to a controlled semi-official release of information. The abuse of the prisoners is hardly an aberration. Indeed, the Clinton prison is notorious for its treatment of those behind bars. According to one local report, in the 1990s, quote, state officials settled a rash of nearly a dozen cases involving alleged brutality by guards against inmates. Indeed, Cuomo himself defended the prison's reputation for abuse in an interview last month, declaring that this was not the time, quote, to second-guess the basic operation at the prison. The basic operation has been fantastic because no one has ever escaped before. This thinly veiled defense of abuse and torture from the governor of one of the largest states in the country has passed without comment from a single political figure, including the various candidates for president in both parties. There have been no calls for an investigation into Cuomo's role or into the claims of the prisoners. The cover-up expresses the fact that for the ruling class, such practices are considered routine and necessary. The torture New York State follow revelations this year that police in Chicago regularly disappeared prisoners into a black site known as Haman Square where prisoners were shackled into stress positions and beaten into confessions to crimes or informing on others. From New York's Rikers Island to Florida state prisons to the overcrowding penitentiaries of Southern California, beatings by guards take place every day. Meanwhile, medieval dungeons have reappeared in America under the Orwellian name of solitary confinement. Every day, more than 80,000 people languish in isolation in America's prisons, including 17,000 children in juvenile detention centers, according to a report appearing over the weekend in The Times. It is not uncommon for prisoners to spend years, even decades, in total isolation. Solitary confinement is classified as a form of torture by the United Nations, with the American Civil Liberties Union reporting that 95% of those subjected to the barbaric practice said it had led to psychiatric symptoms, including hallucinations and panic attacks. Yet in America, children as young as 14 are routinely subjected to this torture. Isolation is often enforced on prisoners who have never been convicted of a crime, as in the case of Caliph Browder, a child prisoner who killed himself this year after being released. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. We look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.